Well, would you turn with me, please, to the passage we read in 2 Samuel chapter 9. 2 Samuel chapter 9, and reading again verse 13. So Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table. Now he was lame in both his feet. Mephibosheth lived in Jerusalem, for he ate always at the king's table. Now he was lame in both his feet. Tonight, we're really focusing on the high point of David's reign. Next week, God willing, we'll see more heights in the reign of David. But when I return from the summer, we'll begin to focus on how David's reign begins to go downhill rapidly. But tonight we're focusing on the high point of his reign and his welcome of this man, Mephibosheth. For those of you who may be taking notes, we're looking at the passage under three headings: the covenant, and then the confrontation, and finally the contentment. Covenant, confrontation, and then contentment. First, we have the covenant in verses 1 to 3. And here the author focuses on David's desire to show kindness to Saul's family. David's desire to show kindness to Saul's family. David is now the undisputed king of the United Kingdoms of Israel and Judah following the deaths of Saul and Abner and Ishbosheth. And David now asks this key question in verse 1. He begins by asking, is there still anyone left of the house of Saul? It's a legitimate question to ask. It would be typical of any ancient Near Eastern king to make inquiries as to whether there were any surviving relatives left of the house of their rivals. And so David is saying, is there anyone still left of the house of Saul, my great rival? But he continues, that I may show him kindness for Jonathan's sake. Now this word kindness is a significant word. The word in Hebrew is hesed. It means covenant love, or steadfast love, or loving kindness that is rooted in covenant promises. You remember in 1 Samuel 20, we're told that David and Jonathan had made this covenant together. We're told that they had loved one another. Indeed, we're told that their very hearts, their very souls had been knitted together in love. And we're told that David had given Jonathan his word, his promise, that he would always show hesed, always show steadfast love, always show covenant faithfulness to the house of Jonathan. And now in verse 1, David is asking, is there still anyone left of the house of Saul that I may show him this kindness, this hesed, this covenant love for the sake of Jonathan? In verses 2 and 3, the author records the answer that David receives. We're introduced to this man, Ziba. He's a servant of Saul's house, a man who would have an inside knowledge into the workings of the house of Saul. And he's brought before David, who now asks him in verse 3, is there still anyone of the house of Saul that I may show the kindness of God to him? And Ziba replies, there is still a son of Jonathan. He is crippled in his feet. It's interesting to note that Ziba doesn't use the name of Mephibosheth. Ziba focuses on Mephibosheth's physical deformity, his physical disability. Ziba is a man, like so many in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, who looks on the outward appearance rather than the heart of the matter. And here he is looking at the outward appearance at this crippled son of Jonathan and grandson of Saul, and he says, well, he's more or less a write-off. I wouldn't bother too much with him, David. Well, friends, what we see in these verses is that David is a man who is constrained and is controlled by covenant promises. We might well consider the thoughts that entered David's mind at this stage. Jonathan was dead. Why keep a promise made to a dead man? Furthermore, nobody else knew about this covenant. David wasn't going to have the nation turn against him for breaking a promise that nobody but he and Jonathan knew about. And let's not forget that this covenant had been made 20 years previously. Time changes things. How often do we hear people say things like, that was then, this is now. Things change. People move on. Time takes its toll. But here's David, and he's controlled and constrained by his covenant promises. Dale Ralph Davis tells the story of B.B. Warfield to illustrate this point. And Warfield was a professor at Princeton Seminary, and he was on honeymoon with his wife Annie, and they were caught in a terrific thunderstorm. And the experience was such a shock to Annie that she never fully recovered, becoming more or less an invalid for life. Warfield could never leave his wife for more than 2 hours at a time. His whole life was limited to the confines of his home and Princeton Seminary. Never traveled. And one of his students noted that when he saw the Warfields out walking together, the gentleness of his manner was striking proof of the loving care with which he surrounded her. For 39 years. All because he had made a covenant to love his wife in sickness and in health. But there's an even more beautiful picture of this covenant commitment in the gospel, where we see that Jesus is constrained and controlled by his covenant promises. From all eternity, he and his Father had been in this covenant, which John Flavel describes as follows. And I know I've quoted it before, but I love Flavel's description of the covenant, where the Father says, "Here, my son, is a company of poor, miserable souls that have utterly undone themselves and now lie open to my justice. What, my son, shall be done for these poor souls?" And the son replies, "O my Father, such is my love for them that rather than that they shall perish eternally, I will be responsible for them. Bring all their bills that I may see what they owe you. Bring them all in that there may be no after reckonings with them. At my hand you will require it. I would rather choose to suffer your wrath than they suffer it. Upon me be all their debt." And the father says, "But my son, if you undertake for them, you must pay the last penny. If I spare them, my son, I will not spare you." And the son says, "I am willing, Father. Let it be so. Charge it to me. I am able to pay their debt. And though it will utterly undo me, though it will impoverish all my riches and empty all my accounts, yet I am content to undertake it." That is the covenant. That is the promise that the Father and the Son make from all eternity. And now, friends, now go to the Garden of Gethsemane. And we enter the Garden of Gethsemane, and we move just a stone's throw away from those sleeping disciples, and we see a man whose face is drenched with sweat and with blood, and he's praying. And he's praying as he comprehends the reality of the cross. And this man, this Jesus, prays, "Father, if it is possible, let this cup, let this death, let this cross pass by me. Father, is it possible?" And the father replies, "No, my son, it isn't possible." And the son says, "Father, why isn't it possible? Father, you have given me everything I have ever asked, so why is it not possible that you take this cup from my hand?" And the father says, "Because we promised. Because we made that covenant to save a people. And you, my son, you promised to be their savior. You gave your word." And the son says, "But Father, they hate me. And they mock me, and they misunderstand me. And Father, there's Peter, and he's sleeping. And he's going to deny with curses that he even knows me. And the rest are all going to turn away and run from me. Father, is it possible?" The father says, "I know, my son, I know, but we promised." And the son then says, "Well, Father, how far do you want me to go? How far?" And the father says, "To the end, my son, to the very end. To that end point where you will scream from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? To that place where you will be able to say, it is finished. And the Son says, Father, not my will, but thy will be done. And he arises from the earth. And he looks around and he sees these men coming to arrest him. And he grasps this cup with both hands and goes triumphantly to that cross. That is our confidence tonight, friend. Our confidence is not based on our commitment. Our confidence is based on our King's covenant commitment. Our great assurance, our ultimate assurance, is based on the covenant that the Father and the Son made from all eternity. And we can only praise and bless his name. Isn't that an encouragement? That tonight you and I do not come into this building, neither do we leave this building saying, how committed we have been. But we come out of this building and we go into this building and we worship in this building and we say, how committed our Jesus has been. That is the covenant. But this brings us second to the confrontation in verses 4 down to 8. And here the author focuses on the meeting between David and Saul's grandson. Verses 4 to 6, the author records the arrival of Mephibosheth. Ziba's told David that there is a crippled son of Jonathan. And David asks Ziba where he is, and Ziba gives the details. He tells David that he's living in the home of Machir, the son of Amiel. And he also tells David that he is living at Lodabar, an area which means no pasture. And with this information, David sends for Mephibosheth and has him brought to him. Don't you love that idea he had Mephibosheth brought? He doesn't just send messengers saying, Mephibosheth, come to Jerusalem. No, David has Mephibosheth brought to Jerusalem. He provides the means by which Mephibosheth can actually come. And on arrival, Mephibosheth falls on his face before David. You see, everyone in David's day knew that it was standard practice that when one king was removed and another put in place, that that king would remove the members of the previous regime to prevent any further rebellion. And here's Mephibosheth, and he's heard a knock at the door, and it's David's soldiers, and they say, the king wants to see you, and we're going to bring you to David. And we can imagine what is going on in poor Mephibosheth's mind as he stands before the throne of David, as he falls before the throne of David. His father, his uncles, his cousin, his grandfather have all been butchered. And now David's soldiers have come to his house saying, the king wants to see you. Mephibosheth's thinking, this is it. This is how I'm going to die. The last surviving member of Saul's clan. Here I am, I've been taken to Jerusalem and they're going to kill me before the eyes of David. And it's at this point that the author records David's words of assurance in verses 6 to 8. David now addresses Mephibosheth by name. He doesn't call him cripple, doesn't call him my enemy's grandson or even Jonathan's son. He calls him by name. Mephibosheth, this is a game changer. Mephibosheth's ears prick up. He knows my name. The king knows my name. Perhaps there is hope for me. And David then assures Mephibosheth's trembling and troubled heart as he commands him not to be afraid. And he tells him not to be afraid because it's his intention to show kindness, chesed, steadfast love toward him for the sake of Jonathan. And then David outlines what this chesed, this kindness, will actually look like. David will restore the land, the inheritance that Saul, his grandfather, had lost. And not only that, David will give him a place at his own table. And having heard all this, Mephibosheth replies, verse 8, what is your servant that you should show regard, that you should show notice for a dead dog such as I? Now, I know, friends, that some of you have dogs and you love your dogs and you regard them as very cute pets. But in David's dog, In David's day, a dog was an unclean scavenger. And Mephibosheth doesn't simply see himself as a dog. He sees himself as a dead dog, the worst kind of dog. He knows he has no promise, no potential, no pedigree. And he's astounded that David would therefore show him this undeserved kindness. And as he bows before David, he whispers, "This is all so much. This is above and beyond my wildest dreams. What am I that you would show regard for a dead dog such as I?" My friends, in many ways, these verses are giving us a window onto the gospel. They're giving us a window onto the good news of salvation. Because the gospel tells us that we're all like Mephibosheth. Just like Mephibosheth, we've lost our first inheritance, Eden, through the sin of our first parents, Adam and Eve. And are now living in the land called Lo-Debar, no pasture, a creation that has been invaded and infested by thorns and futility and hostility. Furthermore, we've been crippled by our own sin and find ourselves neither willing nor able to do anything to remedy our situation before the God whom we've offended. We carry the guilt of our first parents, but we also carry our own personal guilt. We've got no promise. We've got no potential. We've got no pedigree. Paul tells us that we are God's enemies, that we are children of wrath. He even says we are children of the devil. It is a bleak and a hopeless picture. But the gospel also tells us that there is a king greater than David. The Lord Jesus Christ, the King who desires to show us kindness, hesed, covenant love. He's the King who knows us by name and knows our names as he prays at the Father's right hand for us this evening, and will know our names as we stand before his great white throne at the end of time and need one greater than us to plead our cause. He's the King who repeatedly calls on us not to be afraid, because he is the one who has come to restore our inheritance, Eden, to us and place us at his table in his banqueting hall, where he will spread his banner of love over us for all eternity. And he is the King who has secured all these blessings through his death on the cross. Friends, that's the gospel. And there is no greater or more glorious a message to proclaim tonight. And there is nothing more important for you to hear tonight. There is good news for those who have rebelled against God. There is good news for those who have failed God, even those who have been professing Christians for decades. There is good news for those who have lived as enemies of God. There is good news for those who are undeserving. But the question is, friend, how are you responding to this good news? All Mephibosheth could say was, "What is your servant that you should notice a dead dog such as I?" It would have been so foolish for him to do anything else. And how much more foolish it is. How tragic it is for anyone to receive the gospel message that speaks to us of the kindness, the steadfast love, the chesed, the salvation of Jesus, and to turn away from him in unbelief. How, friend, are you responding to this gospel today? Josh Garels has a song at the table where he sings, "Come on home, come home to me, and I will hold you in my arms and joyful be. There will always, always be a place for you at my table. Return to me." And that is my invitation to you tonight, if you are still apart from Christ. My invitation to you is very simple. If you are still holding back from the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, my invitation, friend, is come home. If you are still holding back from the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, my invitation is there is room at the table. And you know what, friend, if I could, I would take you there myself, but I cannot. If I could sit you at the table myself, I would do it, but I can't. I pray that you will come to that table. I pray that you would come to Jesus, but it's up to you, my friend. It's up to you. Come home. There is room at the table. This brings us third and finally to the contentment, verses 9 to 13. And here the author focuses on the privileges Mephibosheth enjoys as David's adopted son. In verses 9 to 11, we hear the exhortation that's given to Ziba. David tells Ziba what he's done. Ziba is once again called to appear before David, and David informs him that he's given all that belonged to Saul and his house into the hand of Mephibosheth. And David then tells Ziba what he must do. Ziba has 15 sons and 20 servants, and they must work the land that David has given to Mephibosheth. Meanwhile, Mephibosheth will eat at David's table. And Ziba agrees to these arrangements where he says, according to all that my lord the king commands his servant, so will your servant do. Now, Ziba's an ambiguous character. He's an ambitious character. If you go on a few chapters to chapter 16, you see that Ziba lies about Mephibosheth. He slanders Mephibosheth. He double-crosses Mephibosheth to gain favor with David. But for now, all Ziba can do is simply obey the king's command. And in verses 11 to 13, we see Mephibosheth enjoying the privilege of sitting at the king's table. We're told, look at the description, verse 11. Mephibosheth ate at the king's table like one of the king's sons. Picture the scene in David's banqueting hall. There's David, the righteous king, faithful to all his covenant promises. There's all David's sons, powerful young men like Adonijah, but standing out from them all is Absalom, full of charm, full of charisma. There's David's daughter Tamar, a woman of outstanding beauty with a God-glorifying heart to match. There's David's military chiefs and nephews, Joab and Abishai, mighty warriors. And there, sitting in the midst of them all, sitting in the midst of the royal family and all their power and all their beauty and all their attractiveness, is the crippled grandson of Saul. And we're told that Mephibosheth had a young son named Micah. That's significant because we could understand if David allowed Mephibosheth to live if he was just a childless cripple. But he has a son. He has an heir. And David is allowing this son, this heir of Saul, to live. And then we come to verse 13, which provides a fitting conclusion to the chapter, where we find Mephibosheth no longer living in Lo-Debar, but living in Jerusalem, living in the city of David, living in the place where the Lord's presence is concentrated. And what is he doing? He is always eating at the king's table, but he is lame in both his feet. Now let's focus on Mephibosheth eating at David's table like one of the king's sons. It's an extraordinary image. Mephibosheth has been brought to David's palace, not as a prisoner, but as a prince. And as he sits with the king's sons, we can see that Mephibosheth has really been adopted, as it were, into the royal family. And that is what lies at the heart of the gospel message. I find it a tragedy when we can reduce the gospel message to simply the message of forgiven sin. I find it a tragedy when we can reduce the gospel message to simply the message of heaven rather than hell when we die. That's pitiful. The gospel is the message of adoption into the royal family of God right now. In his book, Knowing God, G.I. Packer writes, if you want to judge how well a person understands Christianity, find out how much he makes of the thought of just being God's child. Our understanding of Christianity cannot be better than our grasp of adoption. Phil Ryken, in his book, The Message of Salvation, tells the following story, and the young folk here might find this helpful, where he says, there was a little girl who was born so disfigured that even her parents were repulsed by her appearance. The only person who seemed to care for her was her teacher. One day the children were being tested for their hearing, where each child would walk up to the teacher's desk and she would whisper something in their ear. When the little girl stood by the teacher's desk, the teacher quietly whispered, I wish you were my little girl. And Ryken continues, what God whispers in a believer's ear is even more wonderful. He says, you are my little girl. You are my beloved son. Not I wish Callum you were my son. I wish Naughty you were my son. You are my son. You are my son. And every communion we sit at the King's table. It's a table for those who've known what it is to be rebels and failures and enemies of God. It's a table for those who've known what it is to be spiritually poor, spiritually blind, spiritually crippled. It's a table for those who've been in a desperate condition and whose only hope is Christ and His grace. And at this table, we are called children of God. At this table, we are called heirs of God. At this table, we are called joint heirs with Christ. That is the gospel, friends. Adoption into the royal family. But I want to close with the glorious note of promise that this passage closes on. Please look at verse 3. We're told that Mephibosheth was crippled before he sat at David's table. Jump down to verse 13. We're told that Mephibosheth was crippled as he sat at the king's table. See, friends, this is no fairy tale. David's a great king who's adopted this cripple into his royal family, but that's all he can do. He can't heal him. Can't restore him. And so after David's death, what we find is the Old Testament prophets looking forward to a true and better David who will restore the crippled. And that's what we find in Isaiah. That's what we find in Jeremiah. That's what we find in Micah. And suddenly we open the pages of the New Testament and we find this man called Jesus. And we find John the Baptist, the cousin of Jesus. And he says to him, are you the one who was expected? Are you the one who was promised? Are you the Messiah? Or should we expect another king? And Jesus says in Matthew 12, John, through me, the lame, the crippled are now walking. In other words, Jesus is the promised Messiah. Jesus is the true and better David. And all his miracles are little foreshadowings onto that great salvation that he will finally and ultimately accomplish at his second coming. The day, as we said last Sunday evening, the day when the groaning of this broken creation will finally be ended. That is what we look forward to. Von Roberts speaks about an old saint hobbling into church one Sunday. And she smiled at him and she said, you don't know where I can find some new legs, do you? And Roberts replied, well, yes, I do. But you may have to wait a little while. You'll get them when Jesus returns. And immediately she exclaimed, well, that's worth waiting for. That's a Christian hope. We look forward to our covenant King returning and restoring broken hearts and restoring broken bodies and restoring broken minds. We look forward to our covenant King returning and our sitting at his feast. his marriage supper on his mountain, which Isaiah tells us is the place where death has been swallowed up, and all tears and all causes of tears, every deformity, every disability has been wiped away. Well, surely, friends, that's worth waiting for. And that's what this passage closes by encouraging us to wait for: the true and better David and his second coming. Amen.